We're going to continue on here in Exodus. We're in Exodus chapter 18 tonight. And if you have a Bible, you can find that. And also, if you still have your prayer bullets in there, it will, on the back of it, there's an outline that we'll be following along with here. It'll be the notes from the message tonight. So you'll see we're there in Exodus chapter 18. And children of Israel are on their way to Mount Sinai. This account seems to happen right when they get there. You see that here as we read the text. It just kind of makes it a little allusion to the fact that they're there at the Mount of God or at the Mount of the Lord. And it'll say that there in the text. And so they're on their way to Mount Sinai. And Moses here has an important responsibility. Moses is the first of the judges, the leaders that the Lord raises up to lead the people kind of on a national scale. The Israelites are called to be something very different from the rest of the nations of the world. They're not called to have a pharaoh. They're not called to have a king. They're not even called to have some kind of democratic or republican or a parliamentarian kind of a system to lead them. They're called to be truly a theocracy. They're called to have God as their king and to honor God. And then within that and under the law of God, under the system that God puts into place, he does put some human leadership there, but kind of a constantly changing, overturning form of leadership. There'll be the family heads in the 12 tribes, and the tribes had a lot of kind of localized leadership, if you would, of their tribal members. It was really just big families, right? And then there was a judge, often a judge that was over them when it was called to rise up and make important decisions and give important leadership at critical times in the history and in the state of the nation. And so Moses is the first of these. He's the proto judge, kind of the one by which all others will be measured and compared and whose seat they will sit in and all of that. And so far as judge, it's been a lot of big events and it's been a lot of big showy kinds of things. It's been he shows up on the scene and says, hey, God is going to deliver you from the slavery in Egypt and watch this, you know, and then he does some kind of miracle work. He performs some sign, some wonder to confirm the message that he was selling to them. And he goes to Pharaoh and he says the same thing. Let my people go. God says, let my people go. And if you won't, this is what's going to happen. And then Pharaoh wouldn't. And then that thing would happen. And 10 of those miracle works that were performed, then they are finally let go and driven out. But Pharaoh has second thoughts pretty quickly, pursues them down to the Red Sea, and then sign and wonder, parting of the Red Sea. And then they get into the wilderness, and they're running out of water. And so then the waters of Marah are healed, and then they're running out of food. And so God gives manna, and there's this miracle after miracle after miracle. And then we come to this point where it's not the signs and the wonders, it's not the glamorous things, it's not the powerful things, it's not the remarkable things, it's the day-in, day-out grind of what it means to be a judge. People coming to him and complaining. People coming and saying, I've got a problem, and my neighbor, you know, they let their goat graze on my plot of land, and I want restitution. And it's just the little petty things between them. And so Moses is hearing these cases, and he's giving them the judgment, the determination of the Lord, this was the other side of what judges did. You know, everyone wants to be a judge like Moses. Everyone wants to be a judge like Gideon or like Samson, one who is the leader into battle and the great deliverer of the people. But judges also, there's the other side of that, and it was just like the administrative side of it. Which was not nearly so glamorous, was not nearly so exciting. In fact, it was rather tedious, it was rather time-consuming, it was rather demanding of his time and his energy. And Moses, in his meekness, understood that, you know, that was part of the job. Moses, in his meekness, understood that couldn't be the guy who was parting the Red Sea, but then also the guy who wouldn't hear the complaints and the cases between the people. And he had to also not just lead the people out against the challenges and the enemies that are external, but he also had to manage the affairs within the within the congregation in order for them to continue to be successful. And so he is putting himself in a position where he is trying to manage all of this, but it's a few million people, right? And he is giving a lot of time and energy to this, and it all comes to a head here when his father-in-law, Jethro, arrives. That kind of gives us a segue here to our text in Exodus chapter 18. We'll read here a few verses in chapter 1. It says, when Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, and the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, her two sons, of which the name of the one was Gershom, for he said, I have been an alien in a strange land, and the name of the other was Eliezer, for the God of my father said he was mine help, and he delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife unto Moses in the wilderness where he encamped at the mount of God. He said unto Moses, I, thy father-in-law, Jethro, am come unto thee, and thy wife and her two sons with her. And Moses went out to meet his father-in-law and did obeisance and kissed him. And they asked each other of their welfare, and they came into the tent. And Moses told his father-in-law all that the Lord had done unto Pharaoh and to the Egyptians for Israel's sake, and all the travail that had come upon them by the way, how the Lord delivered them. And Jethro rejoiced for all the goodness which the Lord had done to Israel, whom he had delivered out of the hand of the Egyptians. And Jethro said, blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, for in the thing wherein they dealt proudly, he was above them. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. And it came to pass on the morrow that Moses sat to judge the people. And the people stood by Moses from the morning unto the evening. And when Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, he said, what is this thing that thou doest to the people? Why sittest thou thyself alone, and all the people stand by thee from morning unto evening? And Moses said unto his father-in-law, because the people come unto me to inquire of God. When they have a matter, they come unto me, and I judge between one and another, and I do make them know the statutes of God and his laws. And Moses' father-in-law said unto him, the thing that thou doest is not good. And I'll stop there. And again, Jethro comes and kind of points out that what Moses is doing doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and that ultimately, it's not the best way to do things, not the most efficient way to do things. And it kind of brings us to kind of a funny situation here of what our topic is tonight. He kind of offers some unsolicited advice. You know, what we just read here, where did Moses ask him what he thought about it? He didn't, right? And I know that we shrink at the whole idea of unsolicited advice, but this turns out to be a good thing, right? I know that we have a tendency to believe that that unsolicited advice should never, ever, ever be given, or that if it is, that it should be ignored out of hand. But Moses would have been wrong to do that. And I'm going to say here, kind of on both sides, I'm going to play both sides of this issue here tonight. But we have a fine example here of both how to, when it is truly needed, give advice that's not asked for, give counsel that's not asked for, and end up being a help and a blessing that we should be intending to be, and also how to receive it, whether we ask for it or not. And so Moses and Jethro here provide us a fine example of this here tonight. Now, before we get into that, or brings us back to Jethro. And Jethro, we haven't seen since maybe chapter 4 of Exodus, when when Moses takes his leave, he first meets Jethro after he kind of helps protect his daughters from some shepherds who were giving them problems out in the wilderness. And Moses helps them and protects them, defends them against those guys, and helps them to water their flocks. And they bring him home, and he meets his father, meets their father, Jethro. He's called there in the first time we see him, he's called Reuel, R-E-U-E-L. He's also in another, I believe in Numbers, called Raguel, R-A-G-U-E-L, same name. And then he's called Jethro through most of the book of Exodus when we see him here in these last few occasions. I don't know why, what exactly or why he's called by two different names. It wasn't terribly uncommon for there to be different names and be nicknames or common names or whatever it might have been to be known by. I believe it's the same person, no reason to suspect that it's two different people. But it says there that he reminded here that of a couple of things, that Jethro is a Midianite. Now, who were the Midianites? Kind of genealogically, who are the Midianites? So who was Midian? Okay, the Midianites came from the lineage of a guy named Midian. Who was Midian? Who remembers? No, it wasn't out of Esau, but close. Midian is actually one of the sons of Abraham. After Sarah dies, he takes a wife named Keturah, and he has like six, seven, eight sons with Keturah, and one of those is Midian. And so the Midianites are descendants of Abraham, just like the Israelites ultimately are. Isaac was Ishmael, and then Isaac, and Isaac was the son of Abraham and Sarah, the promised son. And so that chosen lineage through Isaac, and then through Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, of whom the 12 tribes of Israel, which kind of brings us out to where we are here. But there were in the land, and we kind of talked about this last week, in the land there were Ishmaelites, also descendants of Abraham. And then there were these other groups that were also descended from Abraham, that were sort of cousins, three, four times removed of the Israelites. And the Midianites were one of those peoples. Now, there's been obviously a few hundred years at this point from Abraham. Several generations have passed since Midian was sent away. When Abraham was dying, he sent everyone kind of into their own way and left all of his good stuff to Isaac. But there's still somewhat of a connection there. It says that Jethro here is a priest of Midian, and exactly what that means, but we're given to believe that there's at least a possibility that he's a priest of some kind of the true God, right? He was a descendant of Abraham. Abraham would have passed on his faith in the true God to all of his sons, not just to Isaac, but to Ishmael and to his other sons with Keturah. And what they did with it, we don't exactly know, but there would have at least been some possibility that some part of the Midianites, though probably not all of them, some part of the Midianites held on to that faith, and kind of get some other impressions from some of the things that we read here, from this very chapter, that Jethro was a believer in the true God. And he makes some pretty impressive statements there. In verse 10, it says, Jethro said, "Blessed be the Lord, who hath delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, out of the hand of Pharaoh, who hath delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord," all capital letters in the Old Testament means Jehovah. "I know that Jehovah is greater than all gods, for the thing they dealt proudly, he was above them." And then he takes burnt offerings and sacrifices. He performs burnt offering and sacrifice before God. I mean, that's not something that God would have just readily accepted from an unbelieving heathen or something like that. And so some reason to believe that he was the priest of the true God, though there was not really a lot of structure around that to this point, because the law obviously hasn't been given yet. And so he was a priest and presumably one of the true God. And he comes because he heard the testimony of what had been going on. He heard about the miracles and signs and the wonders that had taken place in Egypt. He heard about their deliverance. He heard how God had been providing for them. And now they had come into Sinai, somewhere much closer to where the land of Midian would have been. Midian would have been really the land right along the eastern fork of the northern Red Sea, and kind of that land and what would now be very, very southern Israel and northwestern Saudi Arabia, modern-day Saudi Arabia, and kind of that whole coastline there. They would have been much closer to that point. Now, we don't know when, but at some point when God had sent Moses back from the land of Midian back to Egypt to be the deliverer, he took his wife, and at that point it only mentioned his one son, but he took his wife and his son, and they went back with him. At some point, he sent them back to her father Jethro for the time of the Exodus. We don't know exactly why. We're not given any of that information, but at some point, Zipporah and his sons were back with Jethro, and now that they've come out into the wilderness and they're nearing Sinai, or they're at Sinai at this point, Jethro comes to meet with them here and brings his wife and his family back to him. It says here, his name of his oldest son was Gershom, and it says that he named his son that because he had been an alien in a strange land. And that name literally means, to put it in a word, refugee. Gershom means refugee, that Moses felt like a refugee, and what that might have meant, either that meant that he never ever felt like he belonged in Egypt, and when he came out from Egypt to Midian, he felt more at home there, or if he felt even while he was in Midian that he was still kind of a man without a country and a man who was just finding refuge where he could, whether in Pharaoh's house or in Jethro's house. But he just really never felt like he had a home country on this earth. But he named his oldest son Gershom, which means refugee. But then by the time he has a second child with Zipporah, he names this son Eliezer. And Eliezer means the God of help. I mean, because he says that. He says that God, the God of my father, was mine help and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. And we imagine that certainly meant when he first escaped Pharaoh's hand after he murdered the Egyptian taskmaster. But that would have been true really at almost any point in Moses' life up to this point, is that God had protected him, delivered him from what Pharaoh could have done had he wanted to. I mean, all those times in which Moses stood in front of Pharaoh and demanded that he let God's people go, Pharaoh could have had him killed. Could have been executed out of hand. I mean, it would have been literally a word. Moses could have lost his life, and so the Lord had protected him. He understood that. But anyway, Jethro brings Zipporah and his two sons, Gershom and Eliezer, back to him, and they spend some time together. They enjoy some time of reunion and worship together. And then quickly, as we see there, the next day, Jethro quickly perceives really an inefficiency in the way that Moses is doing things. And he's out of a sense of concern for Moses' well-being, and he voices that concern to him. But again, I would say that at no point did Moses ask him what he thought. At least not as what we're recorded for it, and yet Jethro gives counsel that ends up being very important counsel, because the counsel that Jethro gives and that Moses receives and implements actually becomes really the governmental structure of Israel going forward. I mean, until the time of Saul, really the structure of the system of the judges and the way that the family leadership and the tribal leadership is really empowered to help in these matters all comes from a suggestion and a bit of counsel that Jethro, his father-in-law, gives to him. I have a father-in-law. I like my father-in-law. I don't ask him for a lot of advice. I don't ask a lot of advice from anybody. I mean, that's probably a failing of mine. But I mean, you think about how some people feel about their fathers-in-law and probably don't ask them for any advice ever at all about anything. And he might have been mad at him for bringing his wife back. I mean, last time we saw Zipporah, they were in an argument, you know. She didn't have very nice things to say to him. I mean, he's like probably glad she was gone for a while. He's like, what'd you bring her back for? I don't know, I'm joking. But he takes advice from, I don't know, maybe someone it seems like he had a good bit of respect for. I joke about the rest of it, but it seems like, but he didn't have to, right? Certainly didn't ask for it, and yet he received this counsel, even though it was unasked for. We tense up at the thought of unsolicited advice. We ascribe a very negative connotation to these occurrences. But this is a story where good counsel was given, unasked for, and thankfully it was taken, it was received, and it was for the good of everybody involved. Had Moses just said, I didn't ask you your opinion, keep it to yourself, he would have continued to wear himself away doing things all by himself because he felt like he was the only one who had to carry that burden, and he wasn't. And so he received the counsel here. There's nothing worse than having to admit when someone was right about something we didn't ask their opinion on. And takes a little bit of humility in that. I also find it funny, ironic, more accurately, that what I've seen is that the people that are most likely to resent someone giving them advice, giving them counsel unasked for, are also the ones who are most likely to give it to others. And that's something that we've got to understand, too, is that if I find myself really resenting someone else speaking their opinion at me, when I didn't ask for it, I also got to give myself a reality check. Am I guilty of this also? Am I one who tends to voice my opinion to people who don't necessarily want to hear it? And I'm kind of on both sides of it. I'm just, kind of put some honesty in this. I remember when anytime I think about unsolicited advice, I'll tell you an illustration from my own experience here, but I probably do the math, but I don't care. But it was about 16 years ago, let's say that. We had gone, my wife and I, and Mattis was like a year and a half old, and we had gone to two weddings. We had a wedding on a Monday and a wedding on a Saturday in the same general vicinity of the country. And so we'd flown up, gone to one wedding, drove over to the next place, gone to the next wedding. And kind of in the middle, we were just kind of up in the area for a couple of days. Didn't have a lot to do in between Monday and Saturday for the wedding, so we were just kind of doing our own thing. And I was like, well, my wife was a bridesmaid in one of them, and so she had a couple of bridesmaidsy things to do while we were up there. And I didn't have anything to do, and Grandma wanted to keep the kid, and I was like, cool, I'm going to go play golf. And I just mentioned that out loud at like a family dinner. I'm going to go play golf tomorrow. And the bride of this second wedding was like, oh, my dad loves to play golf. He'll probably go play with you. I was like, okay, cool. And then by the time we got to the next morning, it was the bride's father and the bride's brother and the bride's uncle. And fine, so I'm now... I've been golfing like four whole times at this point. I wasn't good at it. I didn't bring my own golf clubs. I'm left-handed, right? So I didn't bring my own golf clubs on this trip because they're expensive to bring on an airplane. And I was like, okay, well, I'll rent clubs. Well, If you're right-handed, you can rent a decent set of golf clubs. If you're left-handed, you get some 40-year-old janky set that's made up, you know, with, like, it's like a crowbar and a baseball bat and a rake. And so I'm a bad golfer to start with. I have bad equipment, and I know a bad carpenter blames his tools, right? But I'm a bad golfer, and I have bad tools, and I'm golfing with people I don't know and who don't know me. And these guys all turn out to be, like, excellent golfers, which was fine. I can handle that. I'm not out there to play against them anyway. I'm there to, like, play against myself. I understand that about golf. And I go out there, and I hit some bad shots. I mean, bad ones. And he goes, "You know what you did wrong there? Yeah, I want you to tell me." Okay, well, that's fine. Every shot. I mean, every shot. Even the good ones. I had a handful of good ones, and he was still like, "You know, could have got a little more out of that one if you." And I'm like, "Man, let me have my moral victories here. You're killing me." I almost quit golf forever that day. I mean, forever. And what kind of Baptist preacher doesn't play golf, you know? Like, that's the whole reason I was there. I was like, I'm grown up, I'm married, I've got a kid, I'm getting old, I'm a Baptist preacher. Like, I'm supposed to play golf, right? Like, there's rules, guys. And I almost quit forever after that. And so every time I think about unsolicited advice, I mean, that was my day. That was worst, one of the worst days of my life. And thank God, right? Like, I haven't had a very hard life. So that was just a rough day. We've all had someone do that to us, badger us with advice that was neither asked for, nor was it helpful, nor was it given in any kind of sincere concern for you. You've had someone walk by you in a restaurant, and they're like, "You know, you really should make your kids act better than that," you know, or something like that. You've had someone come up and give you some kind of piece of advice that they have no idea. It's coming out of left field. It's from a stranger, it's from a person who doesn't know you at all, it's coming from a person who's got some personal animus against you, and they're just trying to take a dig. And I understand, that's not what we're talking about here tonight. And this is not what was happening to Moses from Jethro. Jethro wasn't like, "You know, I'm still mad at you for marrying my daughter, so I'm just going to criticize everything you do always, all the time." That's not what this was. And so, when we talk about unsolicited advice, there are going to be times where somebody has something from a heart of concern valid to share with us, and we are too prideful, we are too obtuse, we are too distracted to ask for the counsel, and thankfully sometimes they give it to us anyway, and it solves a big problem for us, and we have to be receptive to that. And if we're on the other side of it, there are going to be some times where someone that you care about is doing something that is harmful to themselves and ultimately harmful to the cause, and you have an obligation to say something, even if they might react poorly to it. And I think we get a kind of a picture here of how it can go really well on both ends in this story tonight. And so we'll just get into our notes here this evening. When giving unsolicited counsel the way that Jethro gave to Moses, give it because you have a regard for them. I would never walk by somebody in a restaurant I didn't know and tell them how to parent their child. I don't know that person, and they don't know me. Something my pastor said so many times when I was growing up that I'll never forget is nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. So in that kind of a situation, giving that kind of unsolicited advice isn't going to get you anywhere except get somebody mad at you and maybe get something thrown at you. It's not going to go well. But if you truly care about somebody and you see something that is harmful to them, sometimes you've got to speak up. And this is what Jethro did. He saw a need. We see from the early part of this chapter when he shows up that Moses and Jethro did clearly have a mutually respectful relationship, that Jethro cared about Moses, appreciated Moses, respected what Moses was doing and how God was using him, was thanking God for all of the many blessings there. And Jethro gives the counsel to Moses because he genuinely does care for him. I was just cautioning you to really check your motives and your sincerity before you interject. And make sure that the reason why you're saying that is not just to get something off your chest and not just to make a dig or just to speak your mind or whatever it might be, but say it because it's something that needs to be said. And that it would be the right thing for you to say. It would be wrong for you to not say it if you held your tongue. Not only give it because you regard them, but give it after you rejoice with them. This is kind of a more of a practical point, but one of the reasons why I think that it went over better, and one of the ways that it will go over better when we have to do this, when we have to be the Jethro in this situation, is we don't just come off as a pathological critic, pathological antagonist. He rejoiced with him. He credited Moses and his faith with all of these good things and noticed how well things were going in spite of what it could have been, and rejoiced with him in all those things, worshiped with him. They feasted together. Jethro didn't only point out the flaws and the problems. And it would be wrong for us to only ever have negative interactions with people. The only thing I ever say to my kid is, hey, you messed this up, or you didn't do this right, or you forgot to do such and such, and never give credit, never give praise, never give, never rejoice with them, never and take any interest in the other things that they're interested in and that are going well for them. Rejoice with them. And then give it by reasoning with them. Ooh, didn't pop up, did it? Give it by reasoning with them. And in the book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, think of it what you will, but there's an interesting concept. One of the habits that's promoted in that book is one that really sticks in my mind of the seven, is seek first to understand, then to be understood. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. I like what Jethro, his approach to this. He sees what's happening. That he watches how that, it says there in verse 14, Moses' father-in-law saw all that he did to the people, saw how that he sat and heard one story after the other, and one situation after the other, and one case after the other, and doesn't just jump right in there and say, hey, you're doing this wrong. He first asked Moses, why do you do it this way? Because, hey, you never know. There might be a good reason why something is done the way that it's done, even if it seems inefficient, even if it seems illogical. There might be some method in that madness. And sometimes we jump in and we start spouting our opinion. We don't know why something is being done the way that it's being done. And there's purpose behind it. Even if it's not the most efficient way to get things done, it's the right way to get things done. And when we start spouting off before we really understand the situation, we're going to do nothing but cause resentment. We're going to do nothing but cut out our own credibility. We're no longer going to be viewed as someone whose counsel is worth listening to. And so he first asks some questions before he gives his opinion, before he gives his thoughts on it. Then once he hears Moses' case and doesn't really hear like a mandated reason why it is the case, he says, hey, you know, there's probably some other people who could help with this. You know, not every case that you're hearing is like a life and death situation here. Not everything needs a new word from the Lord. There are some established laws and principles and precepts and truths from the Word of God that other people can know, and they can make those decisions and they can make those rulings for you. And you don't have to hear the littlest cases from all of the people. You just need to hear the big ones, the ones where there's a lot of murkiness. There's a lot of gray area. There's a lot of uncertainty in them. And he offers to him a solution in this. It's also here important to understand that since it was unsought for advice, Jethro attaches no stipulation or obligation. You guys are just like me in this. If someone asks you your advice on something or asks you how to do something, and then you tell them, they asked you, and so you told them how to do it. So then if they don't do it the way you told them to, you're like, don't waste my time. Right? That's how I am. I used to, Taylor knows, I used to teach math, science, and all kinds of things. It's like, hey, don't ask me how to do your math if you're not going to do it my way. No, not math. She was one of those students a long time ago. No, it would drive me crazy. Like, students were like, I don't understand this. Okay, I'm going to tell you how to do it. Follow these steps. And then they come up with some harebrained scheme on how they can cut steps out of the way and still get there. And I'm like, hey, don't ask me for my help if you don't want it, right? Don't make yourself feel better by asking for help and then completely ignoring it. But Jethro didn't have that right, did he? If I walk up and I say, hey, you're doing that wrong and let me show you a better way to do it. No, I like my way. Fine. But if you ask, right, like I get to hang some stipulations, I get to hang some obligations there. But if I walk up and say, hey, I think there's a better way you could do this, and someone's like, nah, thanks, that's fine. And so Jethro, understanding this, right, didn't say, now this is what I think you should do, and if you don't do this, hey man, we're quits, like, don't bother me again. He had no right to that, right? And we have no right to get upset if someone ignores our unsolicited advice. Because they didn't ask for it. And I can appreciate that the way that Jethro approached the situation, he felt like there was something that needed to be said. He saw that Moses was going to wear himself out. He was going to burn himself out. He was going to spend all of his time dealing with tedious things that other people could help with. And he wasn't going to have the time to, what he said, stand before God for the people and devote himself to prayer and to the ministry of the word and to teaching other people and investing in other people who could help in those things. He was consuming all of his time on littler things. And he saw that to be the problem that it was. And so he voiced his concern, gave some advice, and let Moses do what he would. Like also what he says to him in, because we didn't get there yet, in verse 23, he says, if thou shalt do this thing and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure. And he says, if God allows this, right, like don't take my word for it. Kind of a point we'll make here in a minute. But he didn't say, I'm the authority on this, but here's my advice. Pray about it. And if God allows this, maybe this would work. And so Jethro is a great model for how to intervene in those kinds of situations when we have to intervene. Now, on Moses' side of things, of receiving the unsolicited counsel, where we finished reading there was in verse 17. Moses' father-in-law said unto him, the thing thou doest is not good. In verse 18, thou wilt surely wear away both thou and this people that is with thee. The thing is too heavy for thee. Thou art not able to perform it thyself alone. Hearken now unto my voice, and I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. And thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear the Lord, men of truth, hating covetousness, place such over them to be rulers of thousands and rulers of hundreds and rulers of fifties and rulers of tens, and let them judge the people at all seasons. And it shall be that every great matter they shall bring unto thee, but every small matter they shall judge. And it shall be easier for thyself, and they shall bear the burden with thee. And if thou shalt do the thing, and God command thee so, then thou shalt be able to endure. And all of this people shall also go to their place in peace. Moses hearkened unto the voice of his father-in-law, did all that he had said. Moses chose able men, all of Israel, made them heads over the people, rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of fifties, rulers of tens. And they judged the people at all seasons. The hard cases they brought unto Moses, and every small matter they judged themselves. And Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went away into his own land. And so I'm having some overlap here, but we see that Moses received the counsel and received it well because it was good. Understand? And I, again, kind of back to our knee-jerk reaction, just because we didn't ask for advice doesn't mean the advice was wrong. It doesn't categorically mean that, right? It doesn't mean that we should reject it just because we didn't ask. And sometimes the reason we didn't ask is because we were too prideful, or we were too stubborn, or we were too afraid, or we were too too hesitant to put our what we feel like our own responsibilities off on somebody else. I don't think Moses was one who was incapable of delegating. I don't think that he was one who was a control freak and wanted to make all of these little decisions for every single person in the nation. He probably just felt like it was his job and it wasn't anybody else's. It was his calling and it wasn't anybody else's. And so it took someone to point out something kind of obvious to him for him to kind of wake up to the reality that was there and to put it into practice. I think what we learned here from Moses, non-reaction to this, really receptive spirit to this, is first that we have to assume that motives are proper and pure. And I think Moses did this for Jethro. I think he understood that Jethro actually cared about him, that he wouldn't have said it if he didn't really mean it, if he didn't believe it. He wasn't taking a dig. He wasn't sniping at him. He wasn't trying to hurt his feelings. He wasn't trying to be rude or disrespectful in any way. He was trying to help. And we can assume, help us in this, if we assume that motives are proper, even if it could be handled maybe a different way, it doesn't hurt to give the benefit of the doubt here. Most well-intentioned, and this I believe this, and I believe this, most well-intentioned and reasonable people will only offer advice unasked for if they are motivated by genuine concern. Now again, well-intentioned, genuine, reasonable people, right? So that's a qualifier. But I would assume that if someone comes to me and says, "I know you didn't ask, but..." And I believe you to be a well-intentioned, reasonable person. I believe that you see a genuine problem. You have a genuine concern for what's happening. And that's why you felt obligated to speak up. I think Moses felt that way about Jethro. That he knew that based on the relationship he had with Jethro, that Jethro would not have said something unless he felt like it was a real problem. And that it needed to be addressed. Secondly, I would say that we need to take their observation seriously. That whether or not they see the whole picture or not, nobody ever can, right? But what they see is what they see, and a perception is to some degree a reality, right? If someone's going to point something out and ask a question and wonder why, then whether they're doing it with good intentions or not, it's worth stepping back and asking, is there some truth to that? I've had people criticize me for the sake of criticizing me, and not with good intentions, but I've taken their criticism and asked the question, is there any truth to that? Not that they're 100% right, not or whatever. But I mean, if I can do that with somebody who I don't think has good intentions, I certainly ought to do that for someone I believe does. And the reason we often tense up in these situations is because we know that there's some measure of truth to what they're saying, and we don't want to admit that. We know that, you know, someone walks by and says, "Hey, your kid's a rascal." And you're like, "No, they're not." You know, and you get mad, and like, and then you go, just for a second, like, "Is my kid a rascal?" Yeah, they are, because all kids are. Not all the time, but like, everybody's kid is a rascal sometimes, right? Like, you know, they might have been trying to make you feel bad about it, and don't feel bad about it. But I mean, like, but like, also be like, well, you know, maybe my kid does need to act a little bit better. Maybe I do need to train him a little bit better, teach him some table manners or something. You know, like whatever it might be. You know, whatever the criticism was, there might be just a little bit of validity to it. And rather than just dismissing it out of hand, we can take some admonition. Their perception may be imperfect. Their prescription may certainly be wrong and inaccurate, right? They can't see the whole picture, and what they think you ought to do may be absolutely wrong, but there's probably a grain of truth in what they had to say. In some humility, we can step back and say, "All right, well, I disagree with most of what you said, but there's something in there that was valid, and I'm going to meditate on that. I'm going to focus on that. I'm going to pray about that. I'm going to search the scriptures for an answer for that. I don't want there to be something like even the smallest little bit of what you said to be true. I want to grow in that area. I don't want there to be a perception of that. I don't want there to be an appearance of that in my life or in my testimony that might hinder the work of the Lord, the good name that we have." And so we can agree that there's merit, maybe even to the smallest degree, merit in their observation. And then, like we mentioned here from verse 23, Jethro says, "If thou do this thing and God command thee so, thou shalt be able to endure, and all his people shall go to their place in peace." And we take the counsel, we hear it out, we give it some consideration, and then we let the Lord actually guide and direct. We don't just do what somebody else says because somebody else said it, no matter how much we respect them. And we take it before the Lord. One man said this: "All advice we receive from men should be tested by remitting the same to God for ratification and amendment." And he had a lot of people that the Bible says in the multitude of counselors there is safety, right? A lot of people and a lot of voices in this world, and 2 Corinthians says none of them is without signification. There's a lot of voices calling, there's a lot of opinions that are out there, there's a lot of good advice and valid methods that are out there. What's the one that you should do? The one that God wants you to do. Okay, thank you for your advice, thank you for your counsel. Now I'm going to pray about it. And I'm going to probably take some of it, and I'm probably going to leave some of it, but thank you, you know, and hopefully we grow and we go forward. Now, did the system, the governmental system here work exactly the way Jethro spelled out? Probably not exactly. Has God changed it and modified it and used it? There's a lot more of a familial tribal element to it going forward. There were the heads of tribes and the heads of homes and the heads of families that were really the ones that were kind of entrusted with this authority. So there's a little bit of a modification to it. We can let God use that person's admonition to inspire some reflection and meditation. And even if their advice is ultimately set aside, God can use the occurrence to produce some growth in our lives because it made us step back and evaluate what we were doing and why, and either make a change or confirm what we were doing was what God wanted us to be doing in the first place. But it makes us plant our feet on something very, very solidly. you never have your, you know, quote, your faith that's not tested can't be trusted. And I guess it's kind of true of everything, right? Like the path that I've chosen, if there's ever a challenge to it, if nobody ever questions why I'm on that path, then I don't really know why I am. And I might never get off of it. And I may not be all that committed to it if no one ever challenges it. But if someone tries to stand in my way, but I know it's God's will and I have to fight through obstacles to stay where God wants me, I'm pretty committed to that path. And if someone challenges me and makes me stop and think maybe I'm not doing the right thing, it can produce a meaningful and important change in the direction that I'm heading. So Jethro's counsel does essentially become the foundation for how things were run and how the decisions were made in Israel really going forward for the next few hundred years. Ultimately, in the story, it allowed Moses to be better able to accomplish his greater calling by following this advice. People that were coming to him were benefited too. It was one of the things he pointed out. He says, look what you're doing to these people. You're making these people show up and stand in this long line because there's only one of you. He says, now if there's other people they can go to and then only the big stuff comes to you, then everybody has a shorter day. Everybody can be more productive. Everybody's lives can be benefited by this. Everybody was helped by Jethro having the courage to give some unsolicited advice when it was really needed, and Moses having the humility to receive it when it was really needed. So, even though it sounds like a terrible thing to say, unsolicited advice is not always the worst thing in the world. And we have to have some discernment about that on both sides. Whichever side of it we're on, have some discernment about whether we really need to give it and whether we should really receive it rather than reject it.